Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. It's our weekly reporter roundtable, where we catch you up on the political news of last week and preview the week ahead. Joining me this week is Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4. Welcome back, Natalie.
Thanks for having me.
Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Welcome back, Laura.
Hi, good morning.
And Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Welcome back, Joe.
Great to be with you, Anna.
We tend to leave international news out of the reporter roundtable, but the war in Gaza is increasingly becoming an issue here at home. Before we begin our conversation, I want to say that we're going to focus on the politics and the protests here in Ohio, but that in no way is meant to diminish or ignore the tragedies unfolding in the Middle East. There are tons of talented journalists reporting on the war in Gaza, many of whom have lost their lives, and I recommend seeking out their coverage for war reporting. But when it comes to how students on Ohio's college campuses feel about the war in Gaza, emotions bubbled over last week into protests.
We are the revolution! We are the revolution!
Free, free
Palestine!
Free, free, free
Palestine! Free, free, free
Palestine! Ohio State joined the growing list of college campuses both here and across the country where pro-Palestinian encampments have sprung up and police are racking up arrests.
Attention, you're under arrest for criminal trespass. You are to leave the area immediately. Proceed to College Avenue, south on College Avenue.
Let's wade into the issues driving the protests here at home. The students at Ohio State asked the university to do two main things. Call for an end to the war in Gaza and divest from companies that profit from the conflict. Now, obviously, that has not happened. Ohio State has not done either of those things. So, Natalie, what are the students saying in reaction to how the protest was broken up?
So I think a lot of the dialogue that we're hearing right now after the protests were broken up is whether or not this was an infringement on free speech, whether or not they had the right to be doing that. And it's a little bit nuanced because back in 2022, a state law was enacted that kind of gave more First Amendment rights to students on college campuses, but also laid out what can and can't be enforced. So, for example, in the law, it says that colleges can impose time, place, and manner restrictions, which we've known to be true in the First Amendment. So it's kind of like, oh, if they say at 10 p.m. these protests have to shut down, then that technically could be true and it could be enforceable by the college.
Yeah, and that's what university spokesman Ben Johnson told a WOSU reporter, that he reiterated basically that university rules state that there's no overnight camping. So, Joe, what has been the reaction at the State House to this?
Well, we've seen mixed reactions at the State House. We've seen, the Democratic leader of the Ohio House immediately responded saying, you know, I'm not taking sides on this issue, but the right to peaceably protest is important. We've seen some of the Republican reaction, the congratulating basically OSU and the Ohio Highway Patrol. There we go. Get it out of my mouth for the way that they handled it. And I mean, it's kind of all over the place. I think it's been a cautious, if I could say anything, I think it's cautious. I think we see the governor taking a cautious approach because here's the problem. I think there's a lot of sentiment that they don't want to come. No, you know, there's a lot of they don't want to take a side in this fight because they see a lot of people, and including lawmakers, see, you know, things on both sides that they kind of sit there and kind of grimace at. So I don't think that we're seeing, you know, a strong one-sided response. I don't know. What do you guys think?
Although I'd say at the State House, I mean, they passed a resolution to support Israel.
Right.
They have a flag flying. So I would say that in some ways there is a clear show of support for one side or another. And I think some state lawmakers are taking to social media to kind of express how they're feeling. But as far as Republican leadership goes, at least the Senate president and the Speaker of the House, they declined to comment last week on the protest. A few other Republican lawmakers who I reached out to said they really don't want to get into this. So while some people aren't taking a side, I think clearly, I mean, just by the resolution they passed and what we've seen on social media, some are definitely taking sides on it.
We had a state lawmaker who called the protesters at OSU the Hamas lobby. So I do think that there are some talking points that, you know, parties are putting out that some people are really going after. If you think universities are too woke, this is a perfect example to go after them. And I think university presidents and just, you know, boards of trustees these days are under a lot of pressure to not seem anti-Semitic at the state and national level, which is why, I mean, at 10 p.m., does that constitute for overnight camping? Because I don't go to bed till like midnight, you know? And so, you know, but I think they are definitely doing like a show for us. And it's interesting how they called Highway Patrol and not Columbus City Police, because Highway Patrol is controlled, you know, as part of the governor's administration, where Columbus City is a Democratic led city. And so they would be answering to those guys.
Natalie, I want to talk a little bit about Representative Munira Abdullahi. She's a Democratic lawmaker from Columbus, and she spoke at the encampment and was also bruised in the ribs during the arrests.
Yeah, that's right. She was at the protest. She says she was body slammed and ended up with a few bruised ribs. She, you know, I talked to her last week, and a lot of what she was saying was what she was seeing was a clear infringement of First Amendment rights. She thinks what happened to the students was unjust and unfair. She said that she doesn't really see how the time, place, and manner argument could have been made in that scenario. She kind of said, you know, there have been other instances where that has not been enforced. So she says she thinks it's unjustly and unfairly being enforced. And she talked a bit about just in general why it's so important for students to have the South Oval to protest on. She says it goes back all the way, you know, decades ago, from civil rights to reproductive rights. She says this has always been a free space for students to voice their opinions, and it's crucially important.
So the Dispatch and the Lantern reported that 36 were arrested, 16 students at Thursday's protest, but the total for the week is 41 arrests, 19 students. And I want to play a clip of Governor Mike DeWine. Here's what he had to say about how the university and the law enforcement agencies struck a balance between First Amendment rights and university rules.
People have the right to express their opinions, but if that gets in the way of other students learning, you know, if they're chanting outside a classroom or a way that is interfering with what goes on at any university, I think the law is very clear. The Constitution is interpreted by the courts is very clear.
He said President Carter requested Ohio State Highway Patrol Thursday evening and that he's been in touch with all of Ohio's public universities. There was also protests at Ohio University, correct? And down in Athens and in Cincinnati. So this is ongoing.
You know, one thing about the governor's comment there, I would point out that anyone who's familiar with Ohio State, the Oval, if you're on the Oval, it's not exactly like you're standing underneath a classroom, screaming up at a classroom. So you're and at 10 o'clock at night, to my knowledge, there are no classes at 10 o'clock at night. So I think, you know, that has to be brought up as well.
I now want to shift the conversation from the local impact of international news to national news, the U.S. presidential race, to be specific. Ohio Senator J.D. Vance appeared on Fox News Sunday and said he hasn't spoken to Trump about being his running mate. And if the former president were to ask him, Vance says he would have to, quote, think seriously about it. Joe, I sort of feel like Ohio is always a bridesmaid, never a bride when it comes to vice presidential picks.
Is that a good or a bad thing? I'm not really sure.
But from Sherrod Brown to Rob Portman, they're always like on that short list somewhere. But yeah. They never get the nod.
Yeah, usually we see a lot of Ohioans on lists like that. But, you know, I think one of the things that we see more these days is, you know, when we see a lot of talk and they talk a long time about who they might pick. But then, you know, when they pick someone, it isn't necessarily the person that they've talked about all that time, you know. So I think as far as Ohio is concerned, and the other thing is, the vice president, you know, do you get more done being a U.S. senator or, what's your role there? I know Harris is, but, you know, the thing is that if you're a vice president, you're in waiting. It's not like, you know, it's largely a ceremonial role.
Well, in waiting to a 77-year-old, as Donald Trump is, or an 81-year-old, as Joe Biden is, I mean, you might be a little closer than you think.
Yeah, and like recent news, you know, J.D. Vance, like, I mean, Donald Trump was falling asleep during jury selection recently. I mean, J.D. Vance at least is young. So that
39.
Yes, he has that going for him, and he hasn't shot a dog like Kristi Noem. So
what?
She wrote a memoir. And she acknowledged shooting a dog and was it a horse?
Yeah, a dog and a goat.
A goat.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So yeah. So America's horrified by her right now. So I think she's not in the running right
it's
now.
It's wild on social media because
I miss
a lot
this story. Oh yes. My goodness.
Oh yes, a lot of politicians, including Biden and Harris, came out with pictures of them with their dogs, and there are all kinds of comments about.
Although
know,
Joe Biden's
dogs
have a little bit of a problematic history.
Yeah, but you know his point is I didn't shoot them.
That's
so,
fair.
You know.
That is fair.
So I think a J.D. Vance, not to change the subject from dogs, but I think a J.D. Vance-Donald Trump pair-up would be really interesting because at least when Vance was running for U.S. Senate, it was interesting. Of course, he got the Trump endorsement and wanted Trump support in the state, and that really did carry him across the finish line, at least it seemed so. But, you know, when Trump came to rally for Vance, he was like, oh, Vance was begging me to come out here, this and that. And Vance just kind of was like, yeah, sure, true. So I just think that dynamic would be really interesting.
And I don't know that, I mean, as much as we debate the value of a vice presidential mm-hmm. pick, Trump's not going to have trouble winning Ohio. That's not going to be a state that he needs to carry to win.
No, he's widely believed to win Ohio by every poll out there, so that I know of.
Yeah, so
there's other considerations, though, like Mike Pence. I mean, Indiana wasn't exactly a question of whether it was going to go Republican, but Mike Pence had the evangelical vote. And so, you know, there's other factors that go into it. You know, maybe I don't know, Trump's got plenty of business acumen and, you know, that's what he campaigns on. And, you know, but then J.D. Vance, you know, he is an influential Catholic. I don't know. It'll be interesting to see what he does.
Yeah, and we'll all have to wait and see whether Ohio will continue to be a bridesmaid. Never quite a bride when it comes to, I mean, I guess Vivek Ramaswamy is maybe floating out there somewhere in the ether. So one never knows. We're going to take a quick break, though. And when we come back, we're going to walk you through the latest details from the House Bill 6 scandal. That's when our reporter roundtable continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to the All Sides Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us is Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, and Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Another piece in the financial puzzle has emerged in the ongoing saga that is House Bill 6, otherwise known as the nuclear bailout bill that took down former Ohio House Speaker Larry Householder. And this new information, gets to the question of just how much FirstEnergy contributed to help Governor Mike DeWine get elected in 2018. New documents show that it was in the millions in so-called dark money that doesn't have to be disclosed and is often funneled through back channels. And it's all, well, perfectly legal. Laura, a bunch of the documents from the Public Utilities Commission were released last week as part of this ongoing investigation, and they sort of shed light on how much First Energy was invested in trying to help Governor DeWine get into office. So what's new here?
There was a meeting of the Republican Governors Association, RGA, and they help, obviously, Republicans get elected to, you know, governor positions. And a First Energy lobbyist met with Governor DeWine, talked with him, and then after that, they donated $500,000 to an RGA PAC that ostensibly that money went to help DeWine, among others, win their positions. Money was given to DeWine in, there was like three different organizations. So they are not part of the DeWine campaign per se. DeWine has no control over them. His campaign bill don't have control over them.
They're not supposed to coordinate legally.
Right. They're independent organizations where they're like, you know, you see the TV commercials a lot. It's like, you know, John Smith, you know, is evil, don't vote for him. Or, you know, so-and-so is so American and so wonderful. You know, those often are dark money groups, and the money went to those. In all, it was around a little over $4 million. And Governor DeWine is saying he doesn't remember talking to the lobbyists at the RGA. He was unaware of this money going into these different accounts on his behalf. Legally, he cannot know that. And then also there was some money that went to his daughter, Alice, who ran for Greene County prosecutor. She didn't win. But I guess First Energy was also part of that dark money, which we were aware of the dark money that was going into. It was strange because of small county prosecutor's race. It was very strange. But then now that we know First Energy, that's kind of new that we know First Energy is part of that dark money. But he, you know, he claims he didn't know that. He didn't know any of this is what he's saying. So more evidence, and he's saying he didn't know.
Joe, the governor won by a landslide in his reelection. But mm-hmm. when he ran against Richard Cordray, it was close. It was a tight race. It was a off-year election year. There was a backlash to President Trump. This is when Sherrod Brown last won reelection. I mean, $4 million, could that have helped push DeWine across that finish line?
Yeah, it could have. But I think, you know, it was, as you pointed out, it was a close race. But we did see that there were some other issues that were at play then. And so I hesitate to say $4 million investment is what DeWine in office. I don't think that that's
we don't want to oversimplify the situation.
Yes, but certainly a $4 million investment, that's pretty good.
Yeah. So there have been renewed calls, let's say, at the State House for greater transparency in the process. But House Speaker Jason Stevens says there's not a viable bill to require that.
You know, the First Amendment and the federal, you know, Supreme Court decisions make it a little more challenging to deal with that issue.
But Democrats continue to push for not only a full repeal of House Bill 6 and other legislative changes to guard against corruption in the future. Here's what House Minority Leader Allison Russo has to say.
We hope that they care about the state's largest corruption scandal and the fact that residents here in Ohio are continuing to pay for this corruption scandal every month when they pay their utility bill.
So, Natalie, there are a number of ethics reforms bills in the legislature. There were ethics reforms bills in the last General Assembly. Are they going anywhere?
Unlikely. Very unlikely. You never know in the State House. Things
never
can change
never.
On the dime, right? But it's unlikely. I think, you know, for example, the OVEC repeal bill, which would repeal the remaining parts of House Bill 6, I don't think it's had a single hearing, and it got introduced early this
year. That's GA. The coal subsidy, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
You know, these ethics reforms bills, it doesn't matter if they have one or two Republicans supporting them or not. They're largely Democratic-led efforts. I just don't think Republicans want to say that something was wrong with the law and this is why it happened. There was a bad player and this is why it happened. I think is probably the better path to go down when they're talking about this scandal.
They often phrase it in terms of the First Amendment rights, and this is how the Supreme Court phrased it also in the case that allowed this unlimited dark money. They say the First Amendment rights of the corporations, like by me writing a check to you, I have a First Amendment right to say that I support you, or I, you know, support an organization that's doing work on your behalf. So that's how they see it. You know, flooding their airwaves morning, noon, and night with this person's good, this person's bad. I mean, you know, that's definitely a privilege that most of us don't have, you know. You always have to wonder, you know, I always ask, why would you do dark money? You know, why? Well, obviously, you're looking at a candidate who in general has a history of being favorable to your industry. So,
you know, the thing that's really odd about this, though, is the magnitude of this scandal. It's huge. This is probably the biggest scandal in state government since I've been reporting, and that's been a while. So, you know, but the thing is, we talk about it. We're all talking about it all the time. But you go outside of this area and you go out to real people and they go, House Bill what? Householder who? PUCO? They don't know. And I think a lot of it just has not resonated with the public. And because it hasn't resonated with the public, the lawmakers don't really have to do much of anything right now.
The thing that always gets me, though, about dark money and Citizens United is that the Supreme Court did say that, you know, there are limits on how much you can contribute to a candidate, but you can contribute to these 501c4s as much as you want. Like, you and I could, corporations could. We just don't have the same amount of money. Mm-hmm. But the court never said that that had to be dark. It did say that they could have to disclose. And there are places where you do have to disclose. So, mm-hmm. like, legally speaking, you can respect Citizens United. You can respect the First Amendment. But you can also require those donations to be public.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think some people, I think the average person in Ohio has no clue this is going on. However, a lot of people I know, they at least know what House Bill 6 is. And what's crazy is people outside of Ohio know what it is who care about energy.
Yeah, that's what's really astounding is you see so many people outside of Ohio who care about this issue. So,
well, the thing is, too, Ohioans are still paying for it on their bills. So it's not something that's... You know, if an Ohioan sees their bill and that their bill's going up and they wonder why, or, you know, that they have these extra charges, part of that, not all of it, but part of it can be traced back to House Bill 6 and the scandal since it hasn't fully been repealed. And then, of course, on the dark money aspect of it, I think that gets, like we were talking about the First Amendment, that gets nuanced too, because what if someone just doesn't want to be tied to political contributions for sake of their job or something like that? So that's kind of the argument that can be made there as well. It's, well, people have the right to donate to campaigns and not have to be outed for where they stand politically.
So I want to move on to a different kind of bill, legislative bills, because the lawmakers actually had a pretty productive week and they moved several pieces of legislation forward. And Laura, I want to start with the decades-long attempt to eliminate spousal rape in Ohio law. So it passed the Ohio Senate 32-0, and now it's going to the governor. Why did this take so very long?
you've got me.
I think,
but I will say that the person building who last legislative session was the only person in the Ohio House to vote against getting rid of the exemption. And the exemption, by the way, is said that you could rape your spouse if what they were passed out or something. But he was like, well, somebody needs to vote for it. He got so much blowback that this time around he voted to get rid of the exemption. So I think, you know, to an extent it was an embarrassment in Ohio that this was allowed for so many years.
And the exemption was that if there's intoxication involved, so essentially you could date rape your spouse, essentially is what it was. So if there was any intoxication involved, that could not be rape punishable, considered punishable by law. And Senate Minority Leader Nikki Antonio said last week before the legislation passed, she said, you know, we've been trying to do this for decades, and I don't want to have to say this, but sometimes when it's an issue that not solely, but mostly impacts women, she said, sometimes legislation just takes a little bit longer to pass.
So it now heads to the governor's desk. He said he was going to sign it. So I believe we were the very last state in the country to eliminate this exemption. So
if we weren't the last, we were at the very, you know, one of the very last, yes. But I want to point out there's a lot of legislation that affects women that has been out there repeatedly in the General Assemblies for, oh, the entire time I've been working in journalism. And they still haven't passed, at least in Ohio. So, you know, what Natalie's saying about some of these issues affecting women never getting passed, that's kind of true if you look at history.
I want to move on to a different bill that impacts child victims of sexual assault. House Bill 322 passed the House last week. It affects, basically, it would make the act of grooming a child for sexual abuse a criminal offense. Natalie, can you tell me a little bit about House Bill 322?
Yes. So right now, under state law, if there is a pattern of grooming, an adult cannot be taken to court. An adult can't be forced to register on any list. A child, you know, there can't be any intervention where you say there's a pattern of suspicious behavior here, there's a pattern of inappropriate behavior here, other than maybe like moving the adult, if say it's in a classroom, moving that student out of that teacher's classroom, for example. But there can't be anything that's punishable, again, by law. So this legislation would change that and make it so a pattern of grooming can be punishable by law. And the whole idea of it, it's a bipartisan bill, the whole idea of it is that if we can catch abusers early on as they're grooming children, then we might be able to stop some of these cases from actually coming to fruition to actual cases of abuse. Obviously, grooming is not a good thing either, but stop it before it gets that harmful.
Or potentially stop it before there's actual, like, physical sexual contact.
Yep.
And so it is out of the House, and I guess it heads to the Senate, and we will see what happens there. What I found interesting was actually there was one Democrat who voted against House Bill 322.
Yeah, I don't know why. I didn't get a chance to ask, but it's interesting. I think when the bill was first introduced, there was some pushback on the legislation because they worried this might impact LGBTQ youth who seek, you know,
sort of adults. Unfairly target them with this.
Yeah, they seek help from adults or they go to certain safe spaces and it could be interpreted as grooming under this bill. So there was a little bit of pushback from that community as well. But I think all in all, it seems like everyone agrees the bill is well-intentioned and will help children.
Joe, speaking of LGBTQ youth, Attorney General Dave Yost wants the Ohio Supreme Court to review a temporary block on a law that would ban minors from obtaining hormone therapy, puberty blockers, and basically certain kinds of medical care, and also ban transgender girls from playing on female sports teams.
Yeah.
This is like a skip from like local court all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was expected. At least I kind of expected him to take that action. I don't know about you guys, but, you know, I think, you know, he skipping it up to the Supreme Court. First of all, it's probably going to end up there anyway.
Yeah, for sure.
But secondly, you know, there is some thought among folks that the Supreme Court will react more favorably, you know, toward the state, toward your side on this issue.
What's kind of interesting, and I'm not a lawyer, so I had a hard time understanding whether this was going to go anywhere, but he is objecting to a temporary restraining order that is only going to last 14 days. So, and he, of course, wants the Supreme Court to and make the decision on this in an emergency manner. I don't know. The court tends to, I mean, what their idea is of expedited it is very different than, like, most people. They are very slow. So we'll see. But so I don't know. They're trying, basically the judge in Franklin County Court said, I'm going to put this law on a temporary hold for 14 days or until we can have a hearing in my court about a longer hold.
Indefinite hold.
Right.
Really. Yeah.
And whichever happens first. And then Dave Yost is arguing in his filing that it's unconstitutional for a bunch of reasons, including the thing that's being challenged is the medical side of it, the transgender youth healthcare part. But yet the sports part also is affected. So he's arguing that's overly broad what the judge did. And so the court did ask the other side to file, a response. And so we'll see what happens.
Oh, basically that there was no standing, right? Because the two 12-year-old transgender girls say it violates four sections of the state constitution, mm-hmm. but they're not making the same claim about athletics, essentially, right?
Yeah.
Okay. A little bit of a wonky, complicated, there's also that question of, is it two bills in one?
That's what I was going to say. It could also get into the whole one-issue law here, where technically legislation is only supposed to address one issue. So is this addressing one issue or more than one issue? At least I haven't seen, and you guys may have seen this before, but I haven't seen any legislation struck down based on that one-issue law before.
No.
Yeah, it's in the Constitution that you can have a single issue. However, it's never successful. But in the 14-day temporary hold, the judge did specifically say that this was two bills that last summer were crammed together into one bill, and that they, and then he kind of went through all the broad kind of areas of state law they both affect. And so he took an issue with the single subject rule, even if historically it's never successful, these challenges.
Yeah, the political reporter hat that I still quasi wear was like, ooh, it's a single subject thing. But
yeah. Mm-hmm.
I have no idea whether that will hold. But, I do think there's been a bunch of these laws in different states, and they've been challenged in both federal courts and state courts. And ultimately, I think some version of them is eventually going to end up in front of the U.S. Supreme Court. Is that fair?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, eventually everything ends up there, right?
And you're seeing different courts do opposite things. And generally the Supreme Court likes to step in when you've got contradictory rulings out of different jurisdictions. And this Supreme Court has shown that they do not shy away from controversy. They like to take on these issues.
Yeah, especially because the transgender sports bills deal directly with Title IX, which is a federal law. So I just assume at some point we're going to see that get there at the very least.
I think the chances are very high that it will.
So there's been a lot of talk about President Joe Biden being on the November ballot here in Ohio. And several top Republican office holders, including the governor, has said, yeah, sure, he absolutely will. But they only have until May 9th to pass this special exemption that would allow him to be on there. So, Joe, first of all, why might he not be on there? And why do we only have until May 9th?
Well, okay, first of all, Secretary of State Little Rose is the one throwing out the May 9th date, okay? Mm-hmm. So there is some disagreement as to whether that date actually is legit.
Okay.
So that's the first thing. But the reason that this is a problem is that the conventions are where the candidates are really certified, nominated, certified, all that.
Yeah.
And the Democratic convention is after the date in which Ohio has set as a deadline for putting a candidate on the fall ballot. So they have to figure, and this has happened before. It's happened, we've seen this happen with Republicans and Democrats in various years. The legislature has passed fixes for those at that time, but they've never really fixed the bill. It's likely to happen again because it just comes up like this. It depends on where they plan the date they plan the conventions. So the legislature could pass a full fix on it, but we're not seeing any sense of urgency at the state house on that. And even among the Democrats, if you talk to the Democrats, they're kind of, talking about, oh, we're going to get it fixed. But, they're kind of ceding some of that to the national party because that's where negotiations are happening. So, I mean, the thing is, I always come back to looking at, if redistricting is on the ballot in November, what is it going to look like if the major party candidate for one of the major parties is kept off the ballot by the other major party? I think that could be, that could be very problematic for those who don't want the redistricting amendment to pass.
Seems. I was just going to say, I wouldn't be surprised if it did pass as part of another bill. Like they do an amendment on the floor, super last minute. And they usually go away for summer recess and a little bit into fall. So I wouldn't be surprised if it's May or June,
Yeah, me too.
Seems unlikely that Biden will not be on Ohio's right. ballot. And I agree. Like, they'll probably either amend it into something or introduce a bill that just goes through both chambers very quickly, whether it's a long term or a short term fix. It just seems unlikely that there's no fix to this at all.
Yeah, I agree. And I think they'll exactly what Laura said. I think it's going to be one of these things where they, you know, the question is, what will they make the Democrats, what will the Republicans who dominate both chambers of the legislature, what will they make the Democrats do to pass this? Will they put the Democrats in a difficult position by attaching something that, you know, deals with this problem to something the Democrats really hate, and then make the Democrats vote against a bill that would fix this problem? I mean, that theoretically could happen, and it has happened in the past with different issues. So
there's also a lot of speculation that this might play a little bit into the speaker's race that we have. Mm-hmm. We have the current incumbent speaker, and then you have the Senate president, who is term limited, who is going to run for speaker of the House against the incumbent, and that they're probably one or both is going to need Democrats to be able to get past the finish line and actually win the speaker gavel. And so that they don't, you know, alienating the Democrats is probably not a smart thing to do.
Nearly everything is connected to the speaker battle.
That was Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4. Coming up, we're going to talk about childcare, abortion, and the new stats on distracted driving. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to All Sides Weekly Reporter Roundtable. I'm your host, Anna Staver. Still with us as we discuss all the news of the State House is Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4, Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com, and Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Laura, you had a couple of stories yesterday on a host of serious issues facing the higher education system, from declining enrollment to high costs and crushing debt. And you also wrote about a number of schools and their challenges, including Notre Dame, the one in Ohio, not the one in Indiana, which is closing after 102 years. What's going on?
So this is going on in most states that don't have a young Latino or other immigrant populations. So, but Ohio's is a little bit more pronounced because our enrollment is going down. It went down 12.2% if you look at the enrollment numbers from 2012 to 2022. And this is the average for all college community colleges and universities public. And so you're looking at the states skewing older in age. So they're no longer of child rearing age. And then also people who are of childbearing age aren't having kids like their predecessors. People are opting not to go to college. I mean, debt is not fun. You know, getting out of college with a four-year degree with, you know, $100,000.
Yeah.
So a lot of people are like, I'm going to go into the trades, or I'm really good at IT, I can self-teach. You know, so people are opting not to go to college. So you're just seeing this shift that's going on. So, I mean, it's... in addition to Notre Dame College in the Cleveland area that's shutting its doors, you had Urbana University a few years back, which merged with Franklin University, and then Franklin University closed Urbana. There was a Catholic two-year school in kind of rural southwest Ohio that closed a couple years ago and is now serving as like a nonprofit helping non-traditional college students in the Cincinnati area. Bluffton University, which is a Mennonite college, they are merging with the University of Findlay, which is, I believe, Church of God or Church of Christ. I'm sorry, I don't mean to offend anybody. But anyway, there are two different denominations. They're going to keep both campuses open, but they're going to merge a bunch of, you know, functions, but try to keep the separate identities going. Hebrew Union College down in Cincinnati, they have finished. They're no longer offering rabbinical degrees, so the current cohort will be done in a couple years, and then that's done. And they're not offering masters and PhDs in Jewish studies. And this is the, you know, Cincinnati is a flagship college for Hebrew Union, and they also are the birthplace of Reform Judaism in North America. So, I mean, and there's more. That's just kind of a summary. So, and then you've got endowment challenges with private schools, and so. So, yeah, and then lawmakers are just kind of looking at it. We have a lot of local control in Ohio, including levies at community colleges at the local level. So you can't really say, like, you five colleges get to have a journalism program and you five colleges get to do mechanical engineering. They can't do that at the state level. Every school's got to figure this out for themselves. However, they are encouraging to sell off buildings that they're not using, especially as more students are doing online, kind of reducing footprint, that kind of thing.
And for those who weren't watching on the Ohio channel, Laura rattled all that off without notes. That was all from memory. Super, super impressive, actually. Joe, I want to pivot and talk a little bit about childcare. So Governor Mike DeWine earlier, was it this month? Yeah, it was in April.
Yeah.
Had a state of the state where he proposed this voucher plan for childcare. Can you kind of explain what it would do and what's been the reaction?
Well, one part of it would raise the limit as to what a family of four could make and still get a child care subsidy to about $60,000 a year for a family of four. And that's up from 145% to 200% of federal poverty level. Another part of it would provide money for child care centers and for more of the infrastructure kind of needs of child cares. But the problem we have in Ohio is I've heard this from the Chamber of Commerce and all of the business groups and from businesses that I've spoken with in the past 3 or 4 years. The business owners say they cannot hire people. There's really a problem getting workers. And in some, and it's really bad in service industry. When I've talked with John Barker in the past, he's talked about, you know, how hard it is to get servers and people who do the dishes and, you know, all those sorts of jobs. And it's worsened since the pandemic. And so you see a lot of businesses who are actually going out of business because they cannot get workers. And one of the main reasons cited, if not the main reason, according to the Chamber of Commerce, is this lack of childcare. And it's eye-opening when you start talking about the numbers here, because the average for a child in preschool childcare is $10 an hour. That's what you're paying if you don't have a subsidy. So that's a lot. I mean, You figure if you're making $30 an hour, that's a third of your paycheck there.
And that doesn't include all the taxes that get taken out of your paycheck.
Exactly.
And the gas to get to and from your job.
Right. So if you're a low-income family and you're struggling, you know, even if you're making 60 grand, you're not sitting there lighting dollar bills on fire, okay? So, you know, the hope is that by extending more of these subsidies, you can get some of these families who are on the bubble, who are trying to decide, does mom work, does dad work, or do we have one parent stay at home with the kids? And right now, it's, you know, a lot of parents are staying on the sidelines with the kids because the cost of childcare is just too high. But if the childcare is made more affordable for families, that could help, you know, bring some of these people back to work so that businesses are not suffering as much from lack of workers.
And next Monday at 11 a.m., after this reporter roundtable, we're going to deep dive into the childcare issue, and we're going to actually have Steve Stivers from the Ohio Chamber of Commerce on. Yeah, it's, I mean, you multiply $10 an hour times two if you have multiple mm-hmm. children, mm-hmm. and the math very quickly becomes right. untenable.
Right, and you know, it's one of the Chamber of Commerce actually held a thing earlier this month that where they had different stakeholders from childcare who talked about this issue, and the Bipartisan Policy Center had Linda Smith there, and she deals with childcare issues, has dealt with them for a long time, and she said, you know, the problem is the model, the business model for childcare. And she said, you know, in the pandemic, when the school shut down, the lights stayed on. The teachers got paid. You know, there was a steady stream of income. But, you know, when you shut down the child cares, that wasn't there. And so she said, you know, child care basically to be sustainable needs to be considered almost like an extension of K through 12.
We won't get into it any further, but like, yeah, I've gone severely down a rabbit hole on childcare. And like, yeah, during World War II, like the Rosie the Riveter age, mm-hmm. the federal government paid for childcares, wow. and they were spectacular. Fun, random fact of the day, and then we'll move on, I promise. But some of these federally funded childcares would prepare meals for the moms to take home with their family. Wow. So like, you could have a home-cooked meal ready to take home with you afterwards. And I was like, where is that daycare? Like, sign me up. But let's actually move on to abortion. That's a weird pivot. But doctors in Ohio are closely watching the U.S. Supreme Court case involving a federal law that requires hospitals that receive federal money to provide treatment in emergency rooms. So this is linked to Idaho's very strict abortion law. And so what has been the reaction here in the state as we're watching this play out?
I think it's called like EMTALA uh-huh. is the name of the federal law, which says that, you know, you even regardless of what state abortion ban you have, 15 weeks, 6 weeks, whatever, if a woman is comes in and she's bleeding out, if she's septic, whatever, you need to provide that abortion. And Idaho says that despite their strict law, women are still allowed to get abortions in their, you know, emergency room. However, abortion rights activists say no, not at all. And so it's really interesting because the Supreme Court was like literally saying, well, what if this organ is dying, but then this organ's fine? And, you know, it was kind of like very, very much like, you know, at what point is it really an emergency? Very interestingly, though, Amy Coney Barrett, who is definitely conservative, was kind of horrified by some of the arguments, like, oh, she wasn't dying that bad. And she's like, what? And so it'll be interesting to see what the ultimate decision comes out of it is. I mean, you have the Alitos, the more conservative wing of the court, who seem to think that Idaho's law is A-okay and EMTALA is still protected. But we'll see.
You know, this is something that the people who tried to, who were successful in getting the abortion amendment passed last fall, this is something they pointed out. And doctors have been talking about it as well, saying that, you know, there's no real clear line in these cases where you have exceptions. You're dealing with a hospital board. You're dealing with attorneys. You're dealing with people making decisions. And they tend to err on the side of not doing abortions in these situations. And also, it takes time. So if you've got someone who's got a really serious problem, they might not, you know, it might be a really bad situation. Either they might, you know, die, or they could have all kinds of problems related to not getting the care quick enough. And so it's very difficult because I hear people talking about all these exceptions in all of these cases, but there's not really anything that the doctors have that they can use that is a hard and fast rule that when this happens, you can do this. You know, there's not a standard.
And in a lot of these situations, it's not the woman facing criminal prosecution. It's the doctors,
yes.
The medical providers.
Right.
And they can lose their license. I mean, it's serious. It's not just like pay a fine. It's like you can no longer practice.
Laura, the distracted driving laws that we've had in place have been in place for a little bit now. And you dove into the data for the first 3 months of this year compared to the same time in 2023. So what do you find?
We found one fewer death that was associated with distracted driving last year between...
So it's like texting on your phone or...
Yes, yes. Last year between January and March, 6 people had died. This year it was 5 people. Serious injury accidents had also... So this is like people who could be, you know, partially disabled as a result of an accident. So those have also gone down significantly, and accidents in general have gone down. The law went into effect October 2 of 2023. And then the Highway Patrol did like an increased citation period for several months beforehand to get people used to it. And still, citations continue to be through the roof. If you don't read the news, you're going to learn about this law because you might get pulled over. Somebody, you know, gets pulled over. They're not, you know, they're not warning people anymore like they were in the 6 months leading up to the law. They are giving you tickets. And so this is very short-term data. This is not longitudinal at all. But so far, it's showing some promise.
And we'll see where it goes from there, because the governor also, in his state of the state, talked about mandatory, well, making seatbelt laws first offense, which, so right now you can't be pulled over for not wearing your seatbelt, but you can be cited for not wearing it if they pull you over something else, essentially.
Yeah, right. And lawmakers are not super on board with that one. They believe, you know, that people are informed drivers, and if they choose to exercise their freedom and not wear their seatbelt, that's their like personal choice. Governor DeWine keeps pointing back to, this is about kids, you know, adults, whatever, but this, you know, kids are getting killed by this. So I don't know. Neither Jason Stevens nor Matt Huffman are interested in this. So
that was Laura Hancock, politics and policy reporter for Cleveland.com. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you to Natalie Fahmy, State House reporter for NBC4.
Great to be here.
And last but certainly not least, Joe Ingles from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau.
Always great to be here, Anna.
And that'll do it for this hour. Thank you for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.